Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.
Thank you, Barry. I want to go ahead and at Los Alamos National Laboratory, we have we never wear suits. And so one of the great problems that I've had this morning is determining, do we button one button or two buttons? And then I look at Joe, and he buttons no buttons.
I'm not used to wearing these things either.
Okay, these are the title here is the analytical results on threads taken from the raised sampling area corner. And that's the other thing. I had always thought that this was Reyes. Now I understand it's Raz or Reyes. So I'm going to go ahead and use Reyes because that's what I was used. And I even made a special call to Sue Benford and she said Reyes. But some people say Raz, so I don't know. Getting started on this was when Ray Rogers requested some help because he wanted an alpha particle source. And I got an alpha particle source for him. He was doing some studies on the penetration of alpha particles into flax. And so I went and to get to satisfy that need that he had, I said, look, we can go get a Coleman-Lantern filament. That has a lot of alpha particles because it's got thorium. And so I went and found one, and he said, now I need to know how many alpha particles are needed in this particular filament. So I said, I'll just go take it to the lab and we'll have it counted. But it's easy to say that. But it is not so easy to do because once you go in with this, they say, oh, that's radioactive. You can't take it back out. So we had to work with that. But we had it counted anyway. And there was 50,000 alphas per filament. And actually, that's 2 pi. That's half the filament. And there was 140,000 betas. So you can imagine when people would go camping and they're in their little tents and they light their Coleman lanterns. They're lighting up to 200,000 dpm. And so it's no wonder people are a little bit the way they are now. But at any rate, after Ray did the alpha particle test, he went ahead and then asked me, I need a calculation as to what is the expected depth of penetration. And so, being a radiochemist, I made that calculation, and he was very happy. But then he gave a little bit of a history of this shroud because I knew about the shroud, but I had never really gotten involved with the shroud. But he said, I've got what he called a spliced thread sample, and I would like to have you analyze this. And, and he looked at that, he showed us the splice thread sample. And he said, could you do XPS analysis? And I said, well, I have access to people who can do it. So he said, that's what I would like very much if you could do an XPS. That's X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy. And I had two people that said that they would really like to do this. One of them was Roland Schultz, who is an expert on XPS, and the other was Cyril O'Peel, who was his postdoc. Cyril O'Peel, as it turns out, was Father O'Peel because he was a postdoc from Boston College, and he was a Jesuit. Well, Ray Rogers said, "I like Jesuits because they can get things done," and because he had experience, I guess, at Turin with Jesuits that could get things done. Okay, after we did the XPS analysis, he said, "What other instruments do you have access to?" And I put a list together, and before I could get him that list, he passed away. And so I had, as Barry said, asked Joan Rogers, what do I do with this? And she said, just keep it. After about 18 months, enter Barry Schwartz. And I had given him the list of capabilities we had. And he said, continue the analysis. And then he said, also, as you continue this analysis, I want you to also work with Sue Benford because she's very knowledgeable in the Shroud. And you're not a Shroudie. I didn't know what a Shroudie was either. So, but at any rate, what did I have to offer? And I explained to Ray is that I had, for many years, been a project leader at the lab, and I had in all one of the things we do at Los Alamos, and you all know this, we make nuclear weapons, but we also do a lot of research into homeland security and nuclear energy and things of that nature. And I said, I have an underground throughout the laboratory of people who have very high-powered instruments, and I have access to these people and these instruments because of the projects that I had been working on, which were classified for the most part. But I gave him this list here, and it was high-resolution photomicroscopy. And the expert in that was Warren Steckel, and you'll see some of this work. Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy with reflectance transmitting capability. Kevin Hubbard was the expert in that. X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, sometimes known as electron spectroscopy for chemical analysis at ESCA. And Roland Schultz is the expert in that. Radioisotope and tube-excited microspot energy dispersive X-ray fluorescence spectrometry. I know. And this is where my expertise lies, is in that little instrument, because I had one of the first one of these that was ever made. And Brian Patterson and George Havrilla were the experts on with that. Time of flight, secondary ion mass spectrometry. Toff Sims with an R500 reflecton by Core Technology. Doug Farr is the expert on that. And OJ electron spectroscopy, Doug Farr also runs that instrument. And then confocal Raman spectroscopy, John Schoonover and Steve Dorn were the experts on that. And on, we of course have the regular scanning electron microscopes and atomic force microscopes and all those. There was available expertise for each of those instruments. But we have to, a lot of the instruments that we do have that are very, very powerful are hot or contaminated with plutonium, americium, curium, neptunium, something like that. So we couldn't use that for the Shroud studies. So we had to always have a cold instrument. And so it narrowed the number of instruments that we had available to us. We had also hot and cold labs and equipment. And the equipment status was important here because in order to justify this so that the laboratory doesn't say, what the heck are you guys doing, analyzing Strata of Turin thing, we had to in some way justify it by saying, look, this is something that we do so that we can develop the most state-of-the-art methods for the intel agencies. And so far, that has worked. We had to develop a sequence of analysis because even though most of you here are very knowledgeable in what this is, what that is, and everything else, we did not. I certainly did not know all these things. And so we had to have a recognition of expertise and the type of sample to be analyzed. But I had seen that thread. And what really helped a lot, was when I went to one of these experts, if I said, would you analyze this piece of thread? Well, yeah, go ahead, we'll do it in due time and let it go. But when I said, this is a thread from the Shroud of Turin, everything changed. Yes, we will do it. And we will do it as soon as we possibly can. That made so much of a difference because you don't know these are all PhDs at the lab. We have a lot of them. And we don't know what they believe or anything else. We never asked that kind of a question. And so I was very, one person even said, I'm going to leave the lab and I will stay here an extra day or two so that I can analyze this little piece of thread. And I said, gosh, that's very generous, but you don't have to do that. We got a lot of other people. No, I want to do it. Because you see, I've worked here at this laboratory on weapons for 20 years, and now I finally get a chance to do something that is meaningful. And that's what he did. Okay. Analytical results in order of analysis. XPS was what Ray Rogers had asked for, and we did it. But the next instrument that was available to us that was cold was a micro doing microphotography, and then Toff Sims. And the Toff Sims guy recommended that we go to FTIR. Then we had to assess some results by calling Ray and Joan, and Ray and Sue, rather. And then we finally did reanalysis of some of these threads, and then we did microspot energy dispersive X-ray fluorescence. Okay, this is the XPS analysis. This just tells something about it. It's not very destructive because it uses soft X-rays, and that's about 1,253.6 EV, which is about the K-alpha-1, K-alpha-2, K-beta of aluminum. So it's a weak thing, so it's not going to do anything to the thread, and then I'll show you what the spectra looks like. This is the spectra from the R1 thread, and I looked at this, and I asked Roland and Father Cyril, "What does it mean?" And he said, "Well, what it means is that there are, and they did different scans on it, is that there is carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen from organic fibers. Also present is unexpected silicon and calcium. The two ends are somewhat chemically similar, but different in concentration. And so we've got a little concentration table here, and you can see that the carbon is on the fuzzy end was 71%, on the twisted end was about 80%. So the carbon is greater on the twist end. Nitrogen is a little different. Oxygen, there's more oxygen in the fuzzy end, and there's more silica on the fuzzy end, and more calcium on the twist end. And we'll show you some pictures of that here shortly. But here's where Sue said, oh, now I can say this is so much carbon dioxide or carbonate, and it made a difference for her. But we went ahead and we took a look at it with a Toff Sims instrument. And let me see, did I go too far? No, okay. And the Toff Sims instrument, while he was looking at this, he said, Bob, he called me up one day and he said, something really terrible has happened. Because they have to pull a very high vacuum on this piece of thread. And when he pulled the high vacuum and took it out and handled it with his tweezers, he said, the little thread broke into three. Is God going to be mad at me? And I said, I don't think so. But it was a very strange thing that had happened. So I immediately sent this spectra to Barry and Sue. And as you can see, the little brown crust, it was as if it had little fibers in it, as if it had been holding these two things together. And so later we did extensive analysis on these. And these are individual fibers from this R1 sample. And you can see what it looks like. And it is hard to get good resolution because these are cylindrical in shape. And you have to, and when you can look at a single fiber, but if you try to look at many fibers, it's difficult to get good resolution, as you can see here and here. Although you can see what these fibers look like, the individual fibers, but that's one fiber on the fuzzy end. Here again, once that broke in two, we made this little fuzzy end here, region one with a frayed end, and then the other thinner one, region two. And so we had a region one and a region two and a crust, and we started to do analysis on these. This is a Toff Sims analysis. It looks at things with a positive Toff Sims spectra, and this down here is a negative Toff Sims spectra. But he had a lot of difficulty because when you look at a thread, the thread itself is not conductive, and so it develops space charges. But still, he said, this analysis that we're looking at look very much like cotton. I don't see anything that looks like flax. And so he said, my recommendation is that now that I think this is cotton, let's send it to the FTIR instrument, and they can look at it and look at it much more effectively. So the analysis was performed using an FTIR microscope in reflectance mode. And And I know when you look at an FTIR spectra, just like I could look at a gamma ray spectra or an X-ray spectra and tell you just what every single gamma ray is, the infrared people, they can look at an infrared spectra and they can say, this is a this, this is a this, this is a this, this is a this. And that's because that's what they do. And that's what that they get very good at it. And this is what this looked like. And you can see from this how the linen is different from the cotton. And the linen has this particular peak here. And it is a carbonyl it's a molecular carbonyl structure, and it shows that particular radical at that point. There's a differences right here, but the cotton, it shows a very broad distribution right in this area here and here and then over here that is different from the linen, but the two are very different. Now, let's look at the regions. Region 1 is the fuzzy end, and region 2 is the thin end. And you can see from this that both regions, region 1 and region 2, are cotton. It's very definitely not linen. And then they took a look at the brown crust to see, well, what the heck is this thing? And yes.
The mouse.
Okay, that's okay. I'll get used to this.
No, but we can't see that.
Okay, but this is the data obtained from the shroud thread, especially from region 2, and it's a very good match for the cotton cheesecloth standard. And the fiber is definitely not linen. Now, data taken from a large piece of crust are very similar to the data from the shroud thread. And but the spectrum may be dominated by embedded fibers. So this larger crust contained within it fibers that it had been holding. And so we did analysis on that. Well, what appeared to be a very small piece of that very fragile crust, and did a analysis on that. And you can see that it's got a different look. Many of the individual fibers in this sample appear to have a small residue from the resin-like material included in the first sample set. So it seems like this crust had been been contaminating what this looked like.
If you do that, we can't see this.
Oh, okay. And okay, very good.
There you go.
And so we then took... all right. Oh, yeah. Uh-oh.
Great, I've got to help a guy from Los Alamos. Here he is. Back. Hold on. Let's get rid of this box. Got not push the button here. Hang on. We're going to get you right back to where you need to be. Hang on. Back to... there you go.
All right. Now I can go back.
If you don't push the button, just slide it around. We'll see it.
Okay. But you can see how in this particular picture that there are areas that have the carbon double bond, the carbon-carbon with a double bond between them, and it is definitely not linen. That's the linen standard, and this is the crust standard. and they're just totally different. So this is not linen. So they went back to look and see, well, what the heck could give this kind of a spectrum? And the closest they could come to it was a terpene-based resin because of the hydroxyl groups. And there's only a limited number of hydroxyl groups in terpene, whereas with the other things, there are many hydroxyl groups, especially in cellulose. And so we went ahead and he made the statement, possibly a terpene-based resin was that crust.
Just click next. Click on the next in the box.
Oh, okay.
And that'll take you to the next slide. There you go.
There we go. Okay. The FTIR analysis, after we talked with Barry and Sue, they said, this is all very interesting, but now we need to send you two other threads. Well, when you got free analysis, why not? And they send us thread number 7 and thread number 14. And some of you immediately know what that is, but I didn't know at the time. We got it from John Brown, so we decided to analyze those threads too. And as you can see, thread number 7 is the red, and the resin-like material from the first sample, they're totally different. Thread 7 also appears to be cotton. Many of the individual fibers in this sample appear to have a small residue from the resin-like material included in the first sample set. So it was contaminated with that bit of residue that we saw. And now, this was thread number 14. This was the first sample, which was cotton. This is the second sample, which was thread number 14. And they're very similar. So spectra from thread number 14 are a good match from the first sample set. And they're both cotton, was the conclusion. All right. Comparison of thread 14 with reference standard. And this gives you an idea. This is the linen standard. And you can see the carbonyl peak here very, very strongly. But here we have thread number 14, and it appears to match cotton. It is definitely not linen. And that was the conclusion that we made from that. But one of the problems in doing work like this is that we don't have a standard that is age-dated like the shroud is, the main shroud. So we had to say, what can we do to compare these things? So we went after, and there was an individual says, I've got a thread. And he gave me a whole history of this thread. And we called it the Tama 4 thread. And he said, this is probably one of the main shroud fibers. And we looked at it. And it turns out that we don't know
if
we don't know if in fact what this Tama 4 purportedly shroud fiber is. It is not a good match for either the cotton or the linen standard. This may be a result of the aging effects, or the material may be something entirely different. We just didn't know. So we didn't want to. We went ahead and analyzed this piece of thread quite extensively, but we didn't. Then we, oops, I got to go back one. Maybe even one more. Okay, that's a TAM of 4, so let's go to the next one. And this is the data focusing on the one sp2-3, the carbon-hydrogen stretch region. And here again, this TAM of 4, it somewhat is comparable with cotton, but it doesn't have the linen characteristic that we would have liked to have seen. Okay, this is a sticky tape sample taken from the Shroud area. Barry said, I've got a sticky tape sample, and you can look and see if there's any, if that in fact contains a fiber from the Shroud. And so we looked at it in many different ways. And that was an interesting little part there, is that it almost looked like that is comparable to that. But and one of the things that I can ask you to do is some of you can look at this and you say, I know what that is. Well, that's fine. You can tell us about it, because this is, here again, individual fibers from this sticky tape sample. And can you tell from that whether this is, in fact, one of the Shroud fibers? And because there were so many things. Here is this flattened, has been talked about as being cotton or being flax, but I don't know. That's 1000X. And so we're looking at here some of these little fibers, and we don't know. When we went to the fiber 14, we saw this, and we said, what the heck is that? And so we immediately showed that to Sue and Barry, and they came up with the different reasons that could have been there. And it turns out that it was John Brown that put it there. He said it was gold iridium wire, but we analyzed it with our energy dispersive system. It turns out that was pure nickel. And so we went ahead and looked at that in different ways. When we got ready to do the FTIR, we completed the FTIR studies. Then we said, let's go to the X-ray fluorescence studies. And you can see that by mapping, they can get the calcium. So there was calcium all through the thread. There was iron all through the thread. This was the R1 sample. There's potassium all through the thread. And there was phosphorus all through the thread. Now, why? We don't know. But there was silicon all through the thread. And there was sulfur all through the thread. So those are all things that are within the thread. And they looked at this. This is a spectra of all the X-rays given off when they used a rhodium X-ray excitation source. And it's pretty obvious that there's minor amounts, but we did not see any aluminum. Silicon, yes. Phosphorus, yes. Sulfur, yes. Potassium was a strong signal. Iron, yes. And with sodium is too low for an X-ray fluorescent instrument, but we could see the sodium with other things, and it's definitely there. This is a relative composition, and you can see that of the elements that we looked at, calcium and potassium were by far the greatest composition in the composite, in the multi-fiber thread, it's still the greatest. There was a silicon hot spot that they focused the spot on, and it gave, of course it's going to give a lot of silicon, it was about 4.7%. The iron hot spot that they found, they looked at it, and it had 2.5% iron, but the calcium and the potassium and the iron were the primary things that there was. And there was surprisingly a large number of sulfur in there. Okay, discussion. The goal of all these analyses was to analytically determine the identity of the cloth on the raised and carbon-14 sampling corner by analysis of three threads taken from that area. The approach was to determine the identification of each of three sample threads by analytical methods and to confirm the identification by comparison to cotton and flax standard. The objectives were to establish a list of analytical instrumentation that is appropriate and available for conducting the study. That was our first objective. To determine the relative effectiveness of analytical methods for material identification of three threads. To conduct the studies non-destructively and without contaminating the samples. Given the main original shroud cloth is linen or flax, we received and analyzed three threads, 8 to 12 millimeters in length and about 0.2 milligrams in mass. The limitations and assumptions for our work, we did not have an actual shroud linen standard. This is a rather critical thing. Just last week, I told them to go ahead and take the sticky tape sample, and according to directions from Joan Rogers, she gave me a procedure for cleaning away the material, the glue from the sticky tape sample, so that we could actually take and look at individual fibers with our FDIR instrument. The three thread samples analyzed are representative of rays in carbon 14 sample areas. That's a limitation and an assumption also. All the conclusions from this study are from actual analytical data of three samples taken from the rays, 1973 and carbon 14, 1988 sampling corner, lower left corner of frontal image area of the shroud. The many strands of fibers from the three threads analyzed gave FDIR signature spectra of cotton and definitely did not give evidence of linen flax fibers. In the first analysis we did, we saw maybe some impurities of flax there, but we went back and they looked at those over and over again and they said, no, this is just cotton. That's all there is to it. The FDIR data confirms the Ray Rogers assertions that he made in the Thermochemica Octa that the material from the radiocarbon area of the shroud is significantly different from that of the main cloth. It confirmed that. The radiocarbon samples was thus not part of the original cloth and is invalid for determining the age of the shroud. That was his two main allegations in Thermochemica Octa. The samples taken for the carbon-14 dating of the shroud in 1988 were all taken from the same corner and were not representative of the main shroud. What was true for the part was not true for the whole. And that's one of the basic rules in doing analytical chemistry is that if you have a sample that you're going to analyze, that sample must be representative of the whole. Especially if this sample is to characterize an area or a population. Here again, the sample must be representative of the whole. And they did not do this. Therefore, the approach used for conducting the age sampling, age dating, was flawed, and the results are therefore invalid. The recommendation, a new age dating must be conducted on samples that are representative of the shroud image area. This is an acknowledgement for the people that worked on this. This is all, they're all Los Alamos people. They're all PhDs and very knowledgeable in their area. And that's it.
Explore the mystery at shrouduniversity.com.